I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. Today, my guest is Dr. Wendy Farley. She is a professor of Christian spirituality and the director of the program in Christian spirituality at San Francisco Theological Seminary. Thank you so much for joining me as a guest today.
I'm delighted.
We're going to be talking about one of the books you've authored, and you've authored many books, but we're going to be talking about three women mystics in your book called The Thirst of God, Contemplating God's Love with Three Women Mystics. And I'm going to let you do the pronunciation because I'm already scared, but these women mystics were from the medieval times, and a lot of people don't know that much about them, but I'm kind of eager to dig in.
Great, me too.
And so before we dig in, I know you do constructive theology, and maybe you can describe that for people who don't know what we're talking about.
One of the things I love about Christianity is that it understands itself rooted in a tradition and in scripture, and it always is experiencing and interpreting the Christian faith in terms of its current situation. And so the experiences of women in Europe in, say, the 14th century are quite different from our experiences, or experiences of people in a Mozambique village or in a Chinese underground church. These are very different, but the vitality of the gospel is such that it speaks to all of these different times and places. And what constructive theology does is simply articulate the Christian faith and gospel in the context of its own time. So Augustine was doing this as he watched Rome fall, and Thomas Aquinas was doing this in the kind of height of the golden age of the Middle Ages. Martin Luther King did this in the context of the civil rights movement. So these are all very different contexts, but all of these people were saying how rich the Christian tradition was to speak to their own time.
Yeah.
So that's what it is, I guess.
Yeah, so you're not taking something and superimposing it on where we are now. You're trying to go back and uncover, a little bit like detective work, to try to uncover what's going on within the context of that historical period.
It's both understanding these different historical periods on their own terms, but also bringing forward the wisdom of these writers and rooted it not only in the tradition but in scripture, and saying, what does this say to us right now in our own time? So we can't simply expect the words of Augustine written as the Vandals progressed across northern Europe and he was living in a besieged city to be exactly the same words that we would hear in our own moment. But we can understand the wisdom of it and see how the living spirit speaks to us now.
What drew you to the three women that you decided to focus on?
I think I just fell in love with them. There are others that I've studied, and I love them as well. But for whatever reason, I just fell in love with them. And they're all quite different. They have some commonalities, but they each have a unique voice, and somehow in the distinctiveness of each of their voices, I just heard so much wisdom and such passion and delight for the Christian faith. So they've been wonderful companions to me for many years.
I was interested in going into the historical context of these times. It's so removed from our context in terms of how females were seen and roles in the church and things like that in this time period. But I'm not that familiar with each one of them and how separated they are in geography or in their time periods. So maybe you could dig into it a little.
Sure. They, you know, from our point of view, they're kind of all medieval mystics, and that's all the same. But from their point of view, they represent a sort of arc where the time changed enormously. Mm-hmm. So Mechtilde of Magdeburg was a young woman in Germany, and or what is now Germany, and she became what is called a Beguine. And the Beguines were women who wanted to live a life of prayer and service, what we might call social work. And they didn't want to marry. Some of them were widows, but they wanted to live a life of celibacy and focus on religious practice. But they didn't want to enter a convent because the convents had their own sort of political, social situation, and they tended to be for wealthier women. So the Beguine movement was a movement of women's spirituality, and they were often very beloved in the towns they lived in. They would teach, they would mourn with mourners, they did a lot of, as I say, what we call social work. They were also perceived to be women of very deep and authentic faith and dedication in a time when the church was becoming more and more preoccupied with power and wealth. And so people were becoming a little alienated in a sense, and they represented a very deep and authentic faith. Mm-hmm. And some of the best writing by women before the 20th century really comes out of this movement. Because it was a movement where they were really free to explore women's spirituality. And they were all very, very dedicated to the church, so it wasn't separated from the church, but they were in communities of other women. And they talked and shared and wrote. So Mechtilde of Magdeburg joined one of these groups as a young woman, and she lived to be pretty old. And by the time she was an older woman, maybe in her 70s or 80s, the mood had shifted. The church began to feel very threatened by a movement of women who were not controlled by men. So they began to repress the movement and try to take away its freedoms. So she ended up unwillingly, I think, in a convent at the end of her life. Marguerite Perret lived in what is sort of between France and Belgium now, which is it's one of the kind of richest spots of this movement. And she was a very great teacher and was considered a sort of a master, you might say, an ama, you know, a mother, a wise woman. She was a brilliant scholar and writer. For reasons that are quite complicated and I won't go into now, she found herself a tool in the king's war, competing for power with the Vatican. She was arrested and imprisoned and was burned at the stake in 1310. Her book circulated anonymously and was never considered heretical. So it's not so much that she herself was so-called heretic. I think one way of put it is she represented this movement very vividly, and they killed her, and the movement really became extremely diminished. Hmm. In Julian of Norwich, it's about half a generation later in England, and she chose a different kind of women's piety, which was an anchoress, and it had some resonance with the Beguines in that it was a kind of piety, kind of practice that women carved out for themselves, where they could practice their spirituality, except it was being bricked into a cell that was attached to a church. And so it was a small room about the size of my office, maybe, and it had a window onto the church so she could participate in services, and a window onto the public square where she would be a sort of spiritual advisor to whoever came to her. She wrote this amazing text. She was never bothered by the church but it was partly because she was pretty invisible. So those are the three women, and she, they don't know exactly when she died, but it would have been near the end of the 13th century. No, the 14th century, sorry.
And because she was an anchoress, she was always going to be in one spot, obviously, and she wasn't going to be somebody with a lot of power.
Right, exactly.
So, but she had, that's, of the three, that's the one I know the most, you know, because it's another time and another context. I always thought it was, you know, it's the strangest thing to think you are, like she dug her own grave and, or something along those lines. It's strange to think that someone would choose that life, but she was dedicated to the church and the people and just kind of gave her life for that. But it was a way to carve out her own kind of spirituality in a time where there wasn't a lot of available to women.
That's exactly right. It's a place of great unfreedom because it's a living your entire, the rest of her life in a cell, really. Mm. I mean, she ate reasonably well. I mean, she wasn't in poverty, but it's very strong unfreedom to live your life in a cell. I mean, that we consider that a particularly harsh punishment. But it was interestingly a site of real freedom for her because she really explored very deeply her spiritual life in a way that she would not have been able to do in most other settings.
What it seems like is that these women mystics, and there were many others besides these women, obviously, but that they came along at a time when the church was very corrupt and political, and they kind of offered something different that was like revival or an authentic spirituality that wasn't really available elsewhere, I think. Would you say that, when did the pendulum swing the other way back to, when did they die out and why did that happen?
Well, they didn't die out completely. Actually, mm-hmm. There was an article about the last Beguine in Belgium just not that long ago.
Uh-huh.
But they really lived as nuns, and they didn't write. They didn't really tend to engage in the kind of public work, the social work. They really became much more cloistered and invisible. Mm-hmm. But so it was immediately after the execution of Marguerite Perret that this movement really, it didn't die in the sense that it didn't exist at all, but it really, really took a huge hit. And the creativity of it and the kind of spirit of it was really killed with her.
Like you said, she wasn't killed for being a heretic, but she had kind of, she was seen as a co-opter of like another political threatening power.
She was killed as a heretic. If you wanted to get rid of your enemy, then you accused them of heresy. That was a very common thing to do. What I meant was that her book, when it was separated from her name, circulated fairly widely through the Middle Ages. And it was never considered a heretical document. Mm. People said, oh, it must have been written by one of the scholars in Paris, or it must have been written by one of the Cistercian monks, you know, because it was a very admired book. That makes me think that she was killed as a representative of this movement in order to destroy the movement.
Mm. Well, what can you tell me about the theology and the spirituality of these women and some of the particular features of it?
Well, as I say, there's similarities and differences between the three of them. Mm-hmm. A couple of the similarities is that they were both very dedicated to contemplative practice. That is to say, a life of prayer and meditation and study of scripture and chanting the psalms and the kind of core religious practices of their time. So they were very devoted and dedicated to that way of life. And they were very, they would, you could say they were really in love with God. They just were deeply, deeply, passionately in love with God. And really, so the dedication of their life was a real joy. They all three lived in a time where the social world around them did not support their dedication. And so they had conflict in their life. They really were God-intoxicated women. The other thing is that, like many contemplatives, they really understood God as love. They did not perceive God as dividing humanity into saved and damned, particularly. They talked about that in different ways. They tended to be indirect about that because it was would have been a problem to say that directly. But all three of them imply that they do not think the human race is divided into saved and damned. They really think that God loves humanity. That's why I called it the thirst of God. That's an expression from Julian, that God thirsts for us, that God loves. And that was something that all three really emphasized, that God, you might say God is human intoxicated. God really loves creation. And God's work is to reunite humanity with God. So they all share that point of view in different ways. Their differences would be, Mechthild of Magdeburg writes very effective, you know, like very emotional poetry. I think that if you read her carefully, she's a very profound theologian. But she tends to write in images, like dream images, sort of, visions. And her confessor, a Dominican monk, thought her confessions, I mean, her visions were from God and encouraged her to write them down. And so that's what her book is. It's a book of her writing and theologizing about the visions that she experienced. And she has a very strong sense of, you know, God as lover. Not only that, but, you know, that she uses a lot of those kind of images drawn from the Song of Songs. Marguerite Perret is really the most amazing theologian. She has a very strong sense of the divine mystery. And she has a very strong sense of the way in which we, as long as we're attached to our thoughts and our own will, we have something between us and God. And so her practice really focuses on what she calls annihilation of the soul. And she doesn't mean that it doesn't exist anymore. She means that our attachments, our mental and emotional attachments, can be trained to dissolve into God. So that we are not ego-centered anymore, and but really centered on God. And Julian of Norwich is the most familiar. She is also a very profound theologian. The first part of her book is a little rough going because her story itself is fascinating. She had an illness, and during that illness, she had this series, this one long vision of communication with Christ. And it starts with this very grisly image of the cross. And so you have to read through this very strange vision of the crucifixion before you get sort of into her theology. But she was very troubled by the conflict between her vision and what the church taught. I won't go on a lot longer about that, but in the end, she, you know, the core of her vision is that God will make everything well. She lived in a time of the Black Death and the Hundred Years' War and Peasants' Rebellion and the beginning of the Inquisition in England. So she lived in a time of enormous loss, death, and persecution. She understood that everything we suffer is just a way to get deeper into God's love, even if we don't see it. And so So that what appears to be suffering, and many Christians interpret it as punishment, she says, God is not angry with us. God is using suffering to bring us more deeply into union with God. So she had, again, this radical sense of God present in our suffering. And the cross was important to her because it's Christ being present to our suffering, you know, having real solidarity with us in our suffering.
And God isn't apart from us. He's down with us in the midst of our suffering and becoming a part of it. And that's really interesting. It's this embrace of the suffering, and we're mystics. I know, really, when do mystics kind of come up in Christian history? I mean, there seem to be periods of time when mystics seem to emerge. And I mean, not that that's a stream that's always there, really, but it seems like there are ebbs and flows.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the first mystic was probably Paul, and John would be another, and certainly the Messiah, you might say. It's, you know, very ancient in our tradition. Athanasius says in the 4th century, God becomes human so humans can become divine. And that was a very common orthodox way of understanding what the Christian path was. It was to be transformed for love of humanity. It was to be transformed to live in the union with God's love so that that love would flow through us to humanity. That we would really be that Christians would represent a different way to be in the world, and it was the way of love. But that's hard. You know, we can't just say, oh, I, you know, share my toys or something. It's it's hard to love all of humanity. I don't myself like the word mystic. My publisher thought it was a word people would understand, but I like the word contemplative, because we can all do contemplative practices. We all pray, we can all sing, we can all read the Psalms, and in our practices feel our egocentrism, our fears, our hatreds and anger begin to weaken, and our capacities for love and compassion and justice to get stronger. And the contemplatives really were dedicated to that. I think it's Christianity is an unusual, you know, there are religious traditions that incorporate the contemplative more enthusiastically, and Christianity has, I think, always struggled with its model of church power, and mm-hmm. that contemplative practices means that you have some access to transformation that isn't just controlled by the clergy. And so there have been times when that's been held in suspicion. It was a time of enormous religious creativity. And so you have St. Francis and St. Clair and the movements they started. Mm. And some of those movements were considered acceptable and kind of reinterpreted slightly by the church, a little away from the more radical vision of Clair and Francis. But some of those movements were repressed. Mm. The ones that tried to stay a little closer to the original vision of St. Francis. There were a lot of movements. There was just a lot of spiritual creativity. So mm-hmm. A lot of fantastic writing of contemplative practice that was these new movements, but also writings by monastics. You know, there's just a lot of happening, and the church, by men and women, lay people, monastics, and a lot of it is so beautiful. And the church was really struggling to see what it could tolerate. Mm. And So along with all that creativity arose a lot of repression, and that was the beginning of kind of violent repression. But it wasn't, so women were part of that, but they weren't, it wasn't a women's movement per se. It was just this period of incredible creativity.
Mm-hmm. And what, can you give us like a reference in time? What kind of, what year, window of years was this?
I would say the early Middle Ages to, like Francis is the 12th century. And the Beguines begin in the 13th century. Julian of Norwich dies sometime in the 14th century. So like the 1100 to 1300s. And then you begin to see a little less of that kind of creativity. From my point of view, the Black Death just decimated society. And so culture just was kind of rolled back. All kinds of even technological things got forgotten. And as Europe slowly built itself out of that decimation, you eventually get to the Renaissance, which is the, 1450. And that's another period of enormous creativity, but it's very different from this kind of spirituality, this contemplative creativity of the early Middle Ages.
Well, there's such a renewed interest lately, I'd say in the last 10 or 15 years, and sure before that, but I'm noticing among younger generations of people in their 20s and their 30s and on up, but especially among younger folks who mistrust institutions and authority or distrust the authority and institutions that they've seen crumble or betray them. I'm seeing such a renewed interest in contemplative practice and education and wanting to know the history in Christianity, but also in some of the commonalities of contemplative and mystic streams within diverse religious traditions and faith traditions. And
yeah,
maybe you can speak to that. Do you think the time is ripe for this renewed interest? And do you have advice for people who are seeking these types of things and what they might do or cautions or?
There's some similarities in our period and the period that generated this kind of creativity. You know, there's huge, huge cultural changes. There's a lot of violence in our public world, a lot of persecution, a huge emphasis on concentrating wealth, which was also happening. That's one of the things that gave rise to these movements, a kind of sense that culture and religion were very preoccupied with wealth and the violence necessary to preserve that. And they were really looking for a refreshed religious vision. And we're in a period like that. We are anxious. There's a lot of change. There's a lot of hate talk. And people want a religious vision that really sees the world differently than that. And the contemplative traditions have always been one of the parts of religious traditions in Christianity where you really have a much purer sense of divine goodness, of the unity of humankind, this sense of universal love and compassion. And that was true 1,000 years ago, and it's true now. I think that people are suspicious of certain aspects of our public institutions, and they want to experience the kind of deep down goodness of things. And contemplative paths are a way to do that. I think it's a very powerful way to do that. And so you do have wonderful teachers and writers now emerging, wisdom schools and retreats and writers. And I mean, it's very, very rich so that people can find these small communities to be a part of. And you're right that it also is related sometimes to interfaith conversation. Contemplatives can recognize their spiritual friends in a lot of different places, mm-hmm. including across traditions.
Yeah, I think I've noticed that there is a receptivity to looking for things that bring us together first instead of looking for things that separate us. And
yeah,
that's kind of a place to begin, because there's so much chaos and there's so much division in our world in so many other respects that you need to start somewhere. And yeah. It seems like a great place to start. And so I'm encouraged that a younger group is coming up in their 20s, and they're saying, we're looking for something, we're deeply longing for spiritual practice and looking at tradition, not tradition of our parents or grandparents, but maybe tradition from 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And what's been happening and what's going on. And are there any resources that you would point them to for kind of a historical overview or a way to dig into some of the history?
Yeah, there's a lot of different things. Some of the names that I really have found helpful talking about Christian spirituality and contemplative practice who have themselves deep roots in these traditions would be people like James Finley, Cynthia Bourgeau, Martin Laird. I should have brought my bibliographies with me. A recovery of the Irish tradition in ways that can be really helpful. I think that the radio show On Being, she yes. often interviews wonderful people.
Yes.
And to listen to those sometimes, you know, you just mm-hmm. get a sense of the spiritual richness out there.
Yeah. Krista Tippett, I had her yeah. as a guest, and she's wonderful. She's just yeah. wonderful. But with the bibliography, you can send that to me, and I will include okay. it in the show notes for this episode, so no one will miss out. That would be really wonderful.
Happy to do that.
In terms of the mystics that you've studied so intently, how do you suppose that their lives and their practices have personally influenced you in your own life and your own spiritual practice?
You know, sometimes I'm a Christian theologian, and I teach, I've been teaching theology for my whole adult life. But I do sometimes feel estranged from the church, not fundamentally alienated, but not very nourished by it. And discovering these, I thought, oh, you know, I'm part of a community that's been around for thousands of years. This isn't just some new thing. It's like these men and women, in this case women, but these men and women have been around for 2,000 years, really hungering for news of the love of God, being a little worried about institutional ways of being, and worried about the diminishment of women in these traditions. And it made me just feel like, yeah, this is my tradition. This Christian tradition doesn't belong only to powerful people. It belongs to everybody. So that made me feel really good. And I'd been studying Tibetan Buddhism, which I find a very profound tradition. But I was really hungry for my own tradition, and to realize that so much of that wisdom is been in our tradition for, again, thousands of years, was really, you know, so to turn from this investigation of other religious traditions, which I respect, but to find what I needed inside Christianity was really powerful for me.
I had also been really ignorant of contemplatives until graduate school, really, and not had any idea that there was a kind of knowing you could have without words, for instance, like mm-hmm. apophatic yeah. prayer, and that yeah. you could do that. You could go there and you could practice awareness and mindfulness, and that was distinctively Christian, like that yeah. it's right in the Psalms that there is ways to connect with the whole body. For instance, I think I had been really stuck in my head, whatever I had been taught in my very Western influenced way was very heady and, you know, memorize this thing and know what this is and have the answers, which mm-hmm. is all fine. Nothing wrong with that. But it really had left out intuition and imagination and the bodily senses and, you know, all the rest of me. And I thought that was just not of it.
Yeah.
Maybe it would be somewhere else. But then to read, like, the writings and of these women's dreams or visions or prayers, it was really astonishing. And I was like, wow, they're tapping into this. And it's mm-hmm. totally, like, my birthright, too.
Yes, exactly.
I found it a kinship.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the Protestant tradition arises with modernity. And so it has a very mm-hmm. small view of what the human being is. It's very intellectually kind of rational, a very narrow understanding of what rationality is. And there's, if we think of ourselves created by the divine, then all of us are created and all of us are open and hungry for the divine. And that means our bodies, our imaginations, our emotions, are that part of us that is deeper than words and images. You know, all of that is made for God. And I was raised Presbyterian, and I'm teaching mm-hmm. in a Presbyterian seminary now. But it's so intellectual that the whole, as you're saying, the whole rest of us is cut off from this nourishment in a way that I don't think God intended us to amputate these parts of ourselves in our desire for God. So the contemplative practices, because they use imagination and body and reason and wordlessness and poetry, and they bring us all on board in our desire for God.
I'm a person who deeply, deeply loves words and reading and studying. And I remember learning, you know, in the beginning was the word, and there was this big emphasis on words and speaking and language and writing. And then along comes my son, who is autistic and can't speak at all, and can't speak till he's 5 or 6, and he couldn't confess with his mouth, you know. And then it made me rethink everything about theology. And then I get into contemplatives, and there's all of a sudden this wordlessness, and then there's, you know, I'm like, well, maybe we can do theology with visual. Maybe we can do theology mm-hmm. with art. How about dance? How about music? How about all the rest of it? And the whole thing kind of blew wide open. And this is the other, you know, the apophatic way of communing with the divine. This is the whole other thing. And language is this itty bitty, beautiful, but itty bitty little piece of it.
Yeah.
And the contemplatives are mentors and guides into this other very rich world. And so I always I think of them as, you know, they're our forebears welcoming us into a very rich promised land.
I think that's a great insight, you know, that they are very comfortable with that part of us that doesn't need words. The other thing I would add to that is that when you are comfortable with that darkness, with that imagelessness, then words work differently. Words don't have to be so literal, so that they have this amazing power, as you've said, and beauty. They don't have to be so solid and certain and one-dimensional. So that you can use the words, you recognize that the words of Scripture are surrounded by silence. I was listening to Krista Tippett interview Yo-Yo Ma, and he talks about music is the silence between the notes. And I think that's what prayer is. It's the silence between the words. And when you can move back and forth between the words and the silence, they both have a real potency that by themselves they lack, I think.
Yeah. And we are also, our lives are also the silence between the words and the silence in all of the moments. And we sometimes rush in with the words because we're so afraid of the silent parts. Yeah.
That's right. And the contemplative path does just make you get friendly with silence and pausing and not jumping in and giving things space. And even just if you're sitting with someone, you know, we often want to jump in and fix or tell or explain. And sometimes you just need to sit in silence with someone for a little bit and let words arise from a deeper place.
Do you think that in your relationships that has been a gift that you've been able to bring in a deeper way into some of your friendships and relationships through contemplative practice then?
Well, I can't speak for my friends and relatives, what they experience, but I would say I would certainly wish that. And I would say that silence doesn't bother me. And that giving people space, giving a problem space, giving grief space, is comfortable to me. And words, they're different. You've given something a little space before you've jumped into it.
Mm. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for creating an expectation for silence and the magic or the power of it, because I think people may be very fearful of it at first. You already kind of invite silence as like another person at the table almost, that it's welcome. Then things can come out in your time together that would have never had a chance to bloom.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's true with our life with God. You know, that if we fill everything with words, then certain things don't emerge. So, yeah, I think you're right that beginning to just enjoy silence and let it be a part of the conversation, so to speak, or another person at the table, as you put it, things emerge. It's like when you plant something, you put it deep in the ground. You let it be nurtured by that darkness. And then it comes into beautiful life.
As I've embraced a different kind of spirituality, not, I always say it like this, and maybe it's hard for people to understand, but I'm not trying to see God as like Superman, please save me.
Right.
But seeing God as with me all the time. And, you know, that my heart is God's home in that sense of not, that God is somewhere else and God is not in the sky on a throne and has a white beard. You know, the different kind of way of perceiving God is that I don't feel like I have to, it's not like picking up the phone and making a God prayer, you know, hi, it's me, Lisa, and I want to talk to you. It's more like you're just, it's just the walk of faith. So you're, you know, with the divine presence, and there isn't a time when you're not, you know, it's just how life is. So then there's plenty of times that you can be, the silence is the prayer too. And it's a big, big difference from seeing the world as a place where you hope that Superman comes and rescues you.
Yeah. I think that's right, and that the contemplative path is one that really incorporates that sense of the divine goodness and presence in every minute. As my teacher said to me, every moment, every person is communion. Everything is the fullness of the Godhead. And just to look in everything for that. So that's one thing, that the contemplative path just weaves that into your life every second, which is different than when you're thinking about going to church on Sunday as being religion. But it also is a different, I think the other thing you're alluding to is it's a different understanding of what the divine power and presence mean. And this time of year when we celebrate the Nativity, and we see that the symbols that are chosen to say, what does God look like when God comes to us? And what we see is a baby born of an unwed mother in a conquered nation in utter poverty. We don't see the signs of king and might and wealth. We see destitution and such tender love and gentleness. You could hardly get a more vivid picture of the power of God isn't Superman, when the revelation that we distinctively have is the coming advent of the Messiah, the incarnation of the divine in human form, is very tender. So it does mean to me that we look for God to hold us up all the time in whatever's happening, rather than a kind of emperor who's going to do this or that, something or other.
Yeah, if anything, the incarnation is a mirror of our vulnerability.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
It's certainly something to be joyful about, but it shows that God is with us. You know, Emmanuel, God is with us. When this gets released, it won't be Christmas anymore, but it's really funny
right.
how the pageantry will be long gone.
Yeah.
By the time this comes out, it'll be like, yeah, just all they'll be left with is Christmas debt, probably. But it's something that's kind of the whole point of contemplative practice, is that you don't have these big God moments where, like,
yeah.
oh, well, I felt this big high. And the idea is that, you know, whether you feel something or not, you're living in a reality where there isn't a place God isn't. There's no there where God isn't, and God isn't a thing. So,
right. Teresa of Avila is famous for having a lot of sort of very intense ecstatic experiences. And John of the Cross, who was her friend, was a little skeptical about all of the drama of that, and described what he called the backdoor path, which didn't have a lot of drama. It didn't have a lot of mystical experiences, so to speak. It was just this fullness of the divine presence all the time. And most especially, I think, for John, in other people. You know, he had so much compassion for other people, poor people, hungry people, sick people. He just had such a tender heart for people. That's the other place we are always seeing our divine beloved. As it's Matthew 25, the sheep and the goats, recognizing Christ in one another is the fruit of the contemplative path. It's not about my own private, wonderful, ecstatic experience. That it's about practices that align us with the divine love, so that we can see with our own eyes the preciousness of every human being.
I'm not sure how familiar you are with Peter Rollins. He's a radical theologian, and he talks about that verse about, you know, if you've done it to the least of these, you've done it mm-hmm. to me, of course. We all know the verse, but talking about that it isn't so much that you're doing for Jesus, like, oh, I'm doing Jesus a big favor by helping these poor people,
mm-hmm.
but that the gospel is actually given to you by them, because they bring the good news, and they evangelize you.
Right. No, that's a great, yeah.
Yeah, they're Jesus to you, and that you're not going to be well until you find Jesus in them.
Right.
And it's like, oh, because it's the kingdom is upside down.
Yeah.
It's a really, like, brilliant point that, like, I don't know, everybody will miss sometimes, you know, we'll all miss it sometimes. But I also think that the idea is missed, sometimes wholesale missed, and we'll think that I'm on the A team, I'm on Jesus' team,
right.
and I get to help you poor thing. But it's like, no, that person is helping me, and, you know, I'm also not any better than they are. You know, it's just like, I, you know, so it's a really interesting thing to see, hopefully with different eyes. I mean, we're all in this process of trying to be refining character and hopefully having this divine love change us completely. Not that we are going to get it all right. I mean, like, just ask one of my kids, they'll tell you.
Right. No. I don't actually really like the word mystic, although it was put in the title of my book mm-hmm. by the publisher. I don't like it because it sounds like there are these certain special people who have mystical experiences. But the contemplative life isn't really like that. It's just practicing in a way that tries to align us more with God's love. And what you're emphasizing is you have to do that. You practice your whole life, and you're not what you dream you would like to be, a medium for that love. You make mistakes, you don't see, you etc. But the contemplative path, there's a sense in which it's like, well, of course, you're human, you're on the path, you practice, but you don't get discouraged about it. You just keep practicing. You just keep every day, you know, doing your meditation, your prayers, do whatever you do, and accept that it's not going to be perfect. I appreciate you saying that. And one of the ways, to return to your point, that we often get confused is to think of this love as being having obligations to somebody or charity towards somebody. And really, I think what he's alluding to in that parable is that you have a tender heart toward the others. And that tender heart is this circulation of love where you're not performing a noble deed. You're being given the gift of seeing Christ in others and letting that love circulate. So I appreciate your point there. That's very helpful.
It's not living a nobler life. It's just seeing reality, hopefully, a little more clearly. You know, the word mystic has always sort of disturbed me, too, because you ask it one person and it means one thing, and you ask another person, it means something else. Like, it could mean ecstatic experiences for some people, like, oh, mystic, yeah, like, you have these experiences where you have visions, or you're, you know, really not in touch with the here and now. Or you can ask somebody else and they'll think something completely different, or they'll think that it couldn't possibly be Christian, that the two things cannot go together, and then and so it's one of those slippery kind of words. And so and contemplative, I'll hear people often saying contemplative, and then you're off thinking that it's a head like almost like a math thing, like, oh, I'm computing numbers. And so it can get really, like, you almost need, like, okay, here's what we're talking about. And and so it's tricky terrain to navigate, but I guess this is what we should have covered at the beginning. So you would prefer to say contemplative versus mystic, right?
Well, I mean, these words, as you say, mean different things, so I'm not going to police anybody's language. But for me, to talk about contemplative practice means you're engaged in practices that anybody can do, and you do them because they're life-giving. Mm. Whereas I do think mysticism, mystic, can evoke this either positively or negatively. Like mystics who have these crazy experiences, they're probably psychotic, they get off on their own head, they don't obey authority, that's not Christian. Or, oh, wow, that's so cool. Teresa of Avila had these visions of Jesus. I wish I had visions. So whether you like it or don't like it, you're imagining some supernatural thing that happens to other people. But contemplative practice, you go to centering prayer. You know, you light a candle. You do these practices to center yourself in the divine goodness. There's nothing magical about it.
It's very accessible, and it's just a different way of encountering prayer or spiritual mm-hmm. practice or spirituality or God. That's the point I would probably like to drive home more than any other one, is what we're talking about isn't woo-woo. It's not woo-woo. It's like part of Christian tradition, but it's also not any kind of departure either. It's just, but if you're from a church where prayer can only look just this one way, then it might seem strange, but.
There's a lot of texts in the Bible that run in this direction, and one that we don't read that often is the Song of Songs. And if you're not reading that text contemplatively, that text is going to sound pretty funny as a part of Holy Scripture. It's a text that really invites you to give up the idea of literal language and remember that the soul and God are in love with each other and they seek union with each other, and that there's a joy in that.
Right. It's otherwise you're going to get really thrown off the trail pretty quick.
Yeah.
I can't remember which of the church fathers didn't, it was too racy to be in the Bible, didn't want it to be in there.
It may have been Jerome, I'm not sure. I can't remember. But yeah, it is.
It's so sexual.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about, as many of the mystics have, is divine union, that's as close as you're going to get with language to be able to describe that. And because that's as close as we know with language and our way of understanding connection with people. This is probably a good place to stop, but I want to make sure that you're able to let people know where to find you and your work as best as they can. It's harder for me to nail down academics when I say where can people find you, but I'm sure that there's places that listeners can find you, if they especially find your book and what you're up to.
Email is great. Mm-hmm. And my email is wfarley@sfts.edu. I'm designing some retreats. I'll be running a retreat this summer, two retreats this summer, and I'll be doing that kind of work more too. And I should find a way to make people, make that available for people to be aware of.
Hopefully we can keep in touch, and when you come out with other things, or we can get back in touch, because I love covering contemplative things, and every time I find another kindred spirit, I'm like, okay, this is, if I had a Rolodex, then I'd be like putting you in my Rolodex, but instead I'll just have you on my contacts, on my Skype contacts.
That's great.
And I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you and your work very much.
If you've listened to the show, but you'd like more information about someone mentioned or a book or a website, all that can be found in the detailed show notes I create for every show. A link to those show notes can be found at sparkmymuse.com for this episode, or you can find them directly at the support page at patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E, patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Show notes cost $1 and include all show notes for an entire month. Thank you so much for making Spark My Muse possible.